introduce our speaker. In my experience, and I've only been sober a little while, there are rare opportunities when you get to see someone come in and watch them really grow. What, Rachel? There are rare opportunities to really see someone come in from day one and watch them grow and really become, not sound cheesy, but like blossom in this program, you know what I mean? There's no other way for me to put that right now, but that's what I've seen happen with Danny. He's, like I said, I met him at this meeting, long ago, and he's completely changed, and I think his story now will be a testament to that. And with that, I give you Danny G.
How's it going, guys? I'm Danny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Danny. Hey, Danny.
And this was the first meeting in Atlanta I went to, and I said to myself, I mean, there's so many people here. I said, holy shit, this is a lot of people. How do I interact with all these people without drugs or alcohol? And I had the same holy shit feeling tonight at the podium, so I'm kind of nervous, so bear with me. But my sobriety date is September 17th, 2012, and... yeah, I got sober in Georgia. I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born in, hey guys, welcome. I was born August 5th, 1987 to a Navy family, and I had a wonderful family. My dad, his two parents were both alcoholics. They split when he was really young, and he lived with his mom. And who I never actually met, but she, he grew up in a trap house for the most part. She found this program before she died, but when he was growing up, he grew up in poverty, and he worked hard for everything he had. He went to the Navy and then med school, and my mom did the same. She was one of six kids. She went to the Navy and paid her way through school. They're awesome, fabulous people, and they have, no matter if they were as awesome as they are, if they were terrible, it wouldn't have really mattered, because I believe they had nothing to do with me becoming an alcoholic. But yeah, so we moved around a lot. I was one of three kids. I have a sister that was, she's 16 months older than I am, and she and I were kind of like running mate. She's a little ball of fire. She's awesome. I still love her. When I first got sober, I wanted to, you know, like push this program on her and get her sober too, but you know, I don't know. She's trying to get her way into these rooms. She hasn't succeeded yet. Maybe someday. I don't know. And then I have a little brother. He's 8 years younger. And we moved around a lot when I was younger. I was born in Maryland. And lived there for like a month, moved to North Carolina, and then moved to Boston, lived there till I was about six, then moved to San Diego, and moved in fourth grade to Virginia, where my parents retired from the Navy. And throughout this whole time, I hadn't taken a drink throughout all those moves. I was just 9 years old. I hadn't found alcohol, and but I can relate a lot to... What I've heard speakers say, that I felt different than a lot of kids. I don't know, I was self-conscious. I felt like I wanted to, like, people to like me, to fit in. I had anxiety. And then we moved to Virginia. I found alcohol about 11. And I had all those, like, I didn't have, like, that. I don't remember what I thought, honestly. I remember the next morning. I remember I woke up. And I had, I was projectile vomiting puke in my boxers in the bathtub. And I had two friends that got drunk with me. One of them didn't drink for a long time after that. And the other two of us got drunk the next weekend. So I don't remember thinking like, oh, this is it for me. But I remember that I did drink again when I don't think normal people would drink so soon. So from then on, I started drinking regularly. This was about 11 years old, I think about sixth grade. And my disease took me downhill rather quickly. I went to high school, and by the time I was 15, I would have, well, actually, my freshman year, let me slow down. I guess I had plenty of time. Water here. All right. What up, dude? So high school started. I was rather gifted at athletics, and I thought that was kind of like my in-group. I blended in with a lot of different crowds. I kind of like, I would hang out with the jocks, with the potheads, with everybody. I didn't really have one set group of people. But I lasted about a year and a half in my first high school, and the first consequence I actually had was, it was some women's sporting event. I don't remember whether it was soccer or I don't know, field hockey or something like that. I was drinking at my buddy's house. He was the goalie of the lacrosse team, and I remember driving there. I'd drinking one like a bottle like this, but filled with I don't remember what it was filled with some kind of liquor, and then I drank 40. 40s were big where I was from. Everybody, Hurricanes, a few people in here can relate to that. Especially when you're underage, you know, they're cheap and they get the job done. But So I rode over to this game, and the next thing I remember, I was talking to a police officer, and apparently I had passed out on him during the game. Or no, after entering the gates, I didn't make it to the stands, but I had passed out on him, and somehow I was in the school with this officer talking to him, and my mom was in the room. And so that got me a 2-week vacation from school, and which I didn't see a big deal with. That sounded, you know, like a good deal, just suspended, and I didn't really take school too seriously anyways at that time. So, and it wasn't lacrosse season, so I didn't really care about that, but and so that, with that same semester, I don't remember exactly how long it was, but I just disappeared for 11 days. I didn't call anybody or talk to anybody, and I went to my buddy's house who had his parents were always out of town. And I went to his house, and, it was snowing out, and we just had like a 11 day long party with, I'm going to try to avoid talking about drugs for singleness of purpose, but it is part of my story, so if I say some drugs, I hope no one's offended in here, but just a heads up. But, there was a lot of outside issues and a lot of alcohol at that party, and it was 11 days long, and I was about 15 years old, and on the 11th day, I remember getting this thought. It was like a little aha moment. So maybe I should go to class. Maybe I should. I missed an entire school week. I was just suspended for 2 weeks, and I almost missed my second straight school week. So it had been like a month. And I hadn't slept at all in a couple days of this party, and I went to my first class. I got through it. I remember that morning, all my friends were like, where the fuck have you been, dude? Like, what have you been doing? Like, you reek of alcohol. You look terrible. They had pizza in our cafeteria for breakfast, and I ate through, like, as many pieces of pizza as I could, thinking it was going to fix the problem of me alcohol oozing out of my pores. And by second period, I actually had to read out loud in my class, and pizza did not fix that problem. I couldn't read. And shortly after that class, I was called to the principal's office, and they gave me the option of either staying and getting kicked out of the school, or they asked me to leave, and I could leave without like any repercussions. So I decided to leave the school and go to another school, but I didn't take any, none of these consequences clicked with me. As a result of that, I was on probation. And that following summer, I went to my first rehab where I turned 16 in. I always remember that night. I was up late doing my normal outside issues and alcohol and just by myself in our guest room, and I hear my dad knock on the door at like 3 o'clock in the morning. He's like, Danny, I just want to talk to you. Well, that's kind of odd. It's 3 o'clock in the morning.
He has work tomorrow. I don't know what he wants to talk to me about. So I said, yeah, hold on, give me a second. And I put all my stuff away and put my sober face on and, you know, open the door. And my dad's, you know, I've been taller than him since I was probably 12 years old. And I opened the door and it was just like bodies at my eye level. It was these two enormous guys. And they proceeded to put me, I was 50, I was a minor, so they put me in handcuffs, drove me to West Virginia, and I hiked around the mountains of West Virginia for 3 months, and that was my first experience with rehab. I love the outdoors. It's fun. It wasn't too bad. But the night I got back, this is the thing. Like, most people, you know, go to rehab 15 years old, I have a problem. The night I got back, my best friend was sitting there with it's so hard to avoid drugs. I don't know how many. Sitting there with a nugget, and he said, you want to get high? And I got high, and then the destruction continued. I managed to, this new high school I went to, shortly after rehab, that was the summer, and then I went to this new high school. And I'd been there for a couple weeks. And Lord of the Rings, I think, had just come out. I don't remember which one it was. And we used to play, like, Lord of the Rings, a video game and stuff. And there was this linked move that Legolas did. And we had just seen the movie. And so we got machetes and went out and started. I'm going somewhere with this. It's not going to be all war stories. This is just the progression of the disease. I ended up going. I thought it was a great idea to get machetes, go out, and pretend I was Legolas. It involved hallucinogens and just seeing Lord of the Rings. And so, long story, I cut my fingers off. I went to the hospital. They sewed them back on. I still can't close them all the way. But so this is how I met all these new friends at my school. I was the guy with the weird thing on my hand. That was me. I was the crazy guy. But somehow, you know, it took me 5 years, and through that, I have 5 state championship rings on lacrosse, which is kind of a shame to say. I don't know a whole lot of people with 5 in one sport, but I made it through high school, and I decided there was this one guy on my team who was going to Alabama, and he was rather good, and I remember thinking with him, like, we had gone on recruiting trips and stuff, and I remember, like, on these trips, they were talking about getting up at 5 in the morning, working out and doing all this stuff, like, even in the off-season. I was thinking, that's really going to get in the way of my drinking and partying, and I just don't think that's the life I want to live, you know? So I decided to go to Alabama instead and just chase women and watch football, and that's what I did. It was not. How am I doing on time? Good. Okay. But that is that whole time. I knew I had a problem. I would actually say to people at parties, they would ask me why I was making such a fool of myself, and I would tell them it's because I'm an alcoholic. Although I did not really know what that meant. It was just kind of my excuse for the ridiculous stuff that I did. And when I look back at that high school period in my life, it was kind of like the consequences were piling up and it didn't really affect anything. I was still going to drink and do what I wanted to do, and the consequences did not matter. And then when I look at my college, it went downhill very quickly in college. I had plenty of downhill to go, surprisingly. I wasn't near my bottom yet. But I remember I just heard a speaker on Wednesday talk about how he would really connected with how he would just never have enough of anything. He would be hammered drunk and fall asleep drinking a beer because he needed that one last sip of beer. And that happened to me countless times. I don't care whether it was an outside issue or whether it was alcohol. If I was planning on having some the next day, I wouldn't have that the next day. I would finish it that night, or I would have way less than I had planned on having. And I just needed more of whatever whatever it was that would get me out of me. And that was my solution. And despite the consequences, that solution had worked through high school. It had made me not worry about the zits on my face or, like, the the insecurities that I have and dealt with my anxieties. It shut those voices up in my head. It was a solution that worked, you know, getting arrested, being on probation, going to rehabs, and getting kicked out of schools. That was just some side problems, collateral damage to the inside my head, all the voices being quiet. That was what I really wanted. And it stopped working in college. I remember I pledged a fraternity down there, which is what a lot of people do, and all my pledge brothers told me I had a problem. I was very quickly not welcomed at their houses. I tried to kill one. I held one out a window once, and I tried to make amends. I tried to make amends to him. He didn't really want to talk to me. I don't blame him. But yeah, they would drink. I mean, they would drink like, you know, college people drink. They drank a lot, and they were telling me I had a problem. And that's when I still would call myself an alcoholic, and I would do. That's when I started doing things like started doing things that were not what I thought were okay. I started going beyond my moral spectrum to get and do the stuff that I wanted, and it kept getting worse. I remember one night I woke up and my roommate and I, who got along fine, his truck had been totaled by somebody in the night, and I had no idea who did it, and I helped him try to find that person. And totaled, I mean beat with a baseball bat. And apparently my other roommate had seen me do it. And I didn't remember doing it, but I ended up having to pay him for that. And it really, this was my first couple of years, and it honestly wasn't even that bad yet. That's when I was still going to the parties, talking with the people. Eventually, after a couple of years there, it became, the parties were in my room in my house, and I was in isolation and hopeless and depression, and kind of had scared, broken a lot of bridges, scared a lot of people away. People, for a very good reason, people didn't want to be around me. I was a tornado. But I did whatever I needed to do to get what I wanted. And so the solution to that was to go work on a cattle station in Australia. And that didn't work either. My disease followed me over oceans. And didn't really matter where I was. My first night there, I was at a rodeo, and I don't remember what was that. I got hammered drunk and peed myself and had to dry it off. And that was the theme of Australia. I didn't have any other outside issues, but I had a lot of alcohol, and I had a lot of peeing your pants incidents. I peed my pants there. I mean, if you're sitting in these chairs, you probably know what peeing your pants is. Just waking up with peeing your pants. Come on now. I sure do. Thank you. But, I worked there for a while, and then I came back, and there I was again. I went back to Alabama for a little while. Started off even lower than I was before, just as depressed, just as hopeless, and stuff that I used to solve my problems wasn't working anymore. So this time I decided I would just switch schools, and I would go play lacrosse, and that would help me. That would be my solution. I should, you know, kept seeing this problem as, you know, if I had made the choice to go somewhere else and do sports, then I wouldn't have all these issues, and I wouldn't be this depressed and lonely. And so I went to Ohio, played lacrosse. I say played lacrosse, but I lasted three quarters of a semester, and it was the off season there before I came back to Virginia, where my parents still were, and over Thanksgiving break. Got a DUI. This is my second DUI. I had a few legal consequences at Alabama, but so this was my second DUI, and I was absolutely hopeless, and this was a bottom for me. I broke down to my parents. I cried. I couldn't take it anymore. I just wanted to die. I didn't know what to do, where to turn. So I went to rehab in California, and there I found I went to a Christian rehab there, and they I found a higher power, but I didn't find a practical program of action. And I went there, and I felt good, and I was ready to go, and I could tackle the world. And they asked me to stay longer as like a servant leader type position. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. Let me just go back home. I don't even remember why I wanted to go home, obviously. I was tricking myself. But I went back home, and I never went back out there. And by that time, I was about, I think, 23, and I didn't get sober till I was 25, and those 2 years were the worst of my addiction by far. Yeah, addiction, alcoholism, sorry, same thing to me. But yeah, for 2 years, I woke up every day, and I would pray throughout the day that because all I could think about was how miserable I was and how I just needed to get this to feel better. It was the same routine every day, and I would pray for a bus to hit me. I would pray for something to take me off this earth, because I couldn't kill myself, and I didn't want to be here, and I didn't know what to do. I just thought, eventually, somebody will find me, I'll be dead, and that's how my life's going to go. So yeah, I went through that 2 years, and I robbed, and I pawned everything I owned. Every pawn shop owners would not pawn stuff to me anymore, because they knew most of my stuff was stolen. And a lot of the periods I would either be living in a basement, or I spent a lot of that time in this guy named Toothless's double wide, who's my buddy. You know, he would always be my friend if I had something for him. Like, I was a self-proclaimed precious metals dealer, antiques dealer, none of which I acquired legally. And so that is where it took me. And through this, I found this girl that I had known in high school. I found her online because I didn't have anything, and she had a prescription like Xanax or something. And I was like, oh, yeah, hey, what are you doing? Trying to act all nice and manipulate her into getting what I want. And I eventually did, and I went over there. And not too long after that, less than a year, we were engaged. And the engagement ring was bought on a stolen credit card, of course. And when I got sober, it was because she would find paraphernalia and stuff all throughout the house. And for the longest time, I would make excuses and say, these people, the sketchy people, whatever, you know, I don't know, I went to the store really quick, and who knows what they were doing in our house, which wasn't really my house at all. But and the funny thing is, her dad owned a pawn shop, and I actually pawned a bunch of her stuff there. But that was a really unhealthy relationship. But so eventually she called me one day, and I'd burned every bridge, except she was the only person who would still buy some of my bullshit every now and then. And every other bridge was burned. And then she called me one day and said, I am leaving you unless you make a list of everything you've lied to me about. And I thought to myself, I was like, well, I can't make a list that long, so I'll make a list of some things. And then I did. And then eventually we went over to my parents' house, and I had this like quasi like intervention, kind of like those shows. And this time I didn't want to be sober at all. I said, I can't recreationally shoot heroin, so I'm gonna learn how to drink and appropriately, and I'm gonna still do some other stuff, and I can manage this. I can figure this out. And I knew I had a problem. Obviously, I'd been to rehab a couple times. I knew what AA was. I had a 90 after that first stint, and when I was 15, I got a 90-day chip, even though I didn't really earn it, because I was out in the woods for 90 days. But I got a 90-day chip. I had been to a few meetings, and so I decided to, this was the only option, the only way I could keep the last person I had to stay with me was to go to rehab. So I said, okay, and I went down to Greensboro, Georgia. And this is perfect. My sponsor told me to get sober at 9:30. It's 9:30. I'm getting sober. Perfect. So I went to Greensboro, Georgia. There's a small rehab there. And didn't want to be sober, just kind of doing the things that people told me, giving the people the answers that they wanted to have, you know, telling people what they wanted to hear so I could get out of there and get home. And I had a plan that we were going to move to Chattanooga. Again, another geographical change that wouldn't have made a difference. But, and 2 weeks into there, she called me. She would call frequently there in that place, drunk at night, and try to get a hold of me. And like the my roommate now, who was a servant leader there, would have to, you know, give him the old neither can confirm nor deny that Daniel Gaston is here. So she would call every night drunk and request to talk to me, and even though she couldn't. But after 2 weeks there, I was able to make a phone call, so I called her. And found out that she had been cheating on me with my friend that I gave my job to, and that we were breaking off. And throughout everything, I'd become a felon. I was, you know, homeless at certain points, and I wanted, you know, I had done terrible things to get the stuff that I wanted to do, hurt people, hurt myself, and, you know. And that was my bottom, breaking up with this girl, and I don't know. I mean, I think it, to be honest, I think it was because my drugs were my higher power, my alcohol was my higher power, and then they were taken away, so she was my higher power, and once that was taken away, I had nothing left to lean on, and I felt alone, I broke down, and I decided that at that point that I was going to, you know, have to actually be honest with people and actually, you know, do what people told me to do and not just to give them the answers they wanted to hear. So for the first, that was 6 weeks long, and for the first time ever, I listened to my counselors at rehab. I didn't go back home right after. They suggested I go to a recovery residence in Dunwoody, which I'm very grateful for to this day. And that was terrifying. I remember, because I didn't know, I never interacted with social groups without something to take those voices in my head, you're not good enough, like, there's the anxiety and all, everything that I would deal with in my head. I didn't know how to, like, interact with people without shutting that off with alcohol or drugs. And so I actually, he actually comes here a lot, Drew B., drove me to this. He came and picked me up and drove me to this meeting and introduced me to my sponsor. This was the very first meeting that I came to while in Atlanta, really, when I got sober. Take another sip and kill like 15 seconds. But that was a big thing for me, is realizing that I'm terrified of a lot of things and that I can't run from them anymore now that I was sober. So I went to this meeting, and I didn't want to find a sponsor. I didn't know really what that meant, but I knew that meant that I had to ask a guy, that call a guy every day that I didn't know, and I had to like sit down and have coffee with like a stranger and get intimate with them. I didn't really know what that meant, but it sounded weird, and I didn't want to do it. And I was scared of that, but something kept me going. That's one thing that I have found. Every time that I wanted to be sober or needed to be sober, it did not matter. And this time, I didn't really want to be sober. I needed to be sober, but I did the work, and that has been what has kept me sober. I face my fears. I'm terrified of speaking in front of people, but I get up at podiums and talk because that's, I need to pass the message on. And I came to this meeting. I found a sponsor sitting right there. This great guy, William. And he took me through the steps, and we read the book, which I always think is so weird. Even I read stuff today, and I forget that I'm like, why didn't I highlight that passage? Or I read stuff today that just clicks with me. Every time I go through it, something else will click with me. And every time, it really seems weird to me how some guy 75 years ago, like a 45-year-old like stockbroker, inside trader, and a doctor who just drank, knows exactly how I feel and can relate to me. Like 75 years later, I think that's just boggles my mind. And something that my good friend Martin over here came in late. Tells me a lot. I'm kidding, buddy. He tells me a lot is that you are unique, your disease is not. And that is so true that I may not know a lot of you in here, but I know that you were hopeless at one point, and I know you don't want to be hopeless anymore. Just the fact that I can connect with you on that level, you know, that means a lot more to me than just some of my pledge brothers in my fraternity. You know, this is the most badass fraternity I think there is. And it's really like that passage where it talks about the survivors of a liner wreck, I think of the Titanic, in a lifeboat together. You know, a lot of us wouldn't mix outside, but I think it's really cool how we can all relate on that level. So I guess, yeah, where was I? I went on a little tangent there. No, but I went through the first three steps with him. We went through the book. I don't know if I really was sane at that moment. I needed my sponsor in that recovery residence as far as step two. I needed them to hold me accountable because I wasn't sane. I still am not sane at many moments today. I need the people around me to say, like, that's not a very good idea, or, you know. But a lot of sanity has been restored, and step one, I feel like I took many moons ago. I knew that I was powerless, and my life was unmanageable. I just didn't know that there was another way to live. I thought that was the only thing to do. And step three, what we actually did was, you know, we got down and we prayed and we said third step prayer. But, you know, those three steps I feel like I take every morning when I get down and I pray and I ask God for God's will to be done, because I'm saying I can't do this on my own. And second off, I really like to control things. You know that part in the Big Book where it talks about the director of the play? I fucking love to direct the play. Especially, I have a lot of things going on in my life, and I, like, make plans, and I'll try to, you know, put one piece over here, and this has to happen at this time, and that has to happen at this time, and to just let go and just be like, all right, God, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to try hard, and whatever's happening, I'm going to be available. And to do that, and to pray for that in the morning, that's big for me, to let go of those things. But, I kind of feel like I do those three steps every morning. I've done 2 fourth steps since I got sober. That was a cool experience. You know, I didn't really have any, like, amazing moment after. I just kind of, I had lied to therapists, to counselors, to people who tried to hypnotize me, put me on medications, and people had tried. There have been a lot of attempts to get me sober, and I'd never told one of them the truth. So it was just really powerful for me to sit down and say, this is the crazy shit I've done. These are the people I hate and I'm angry at, and I just feel like have wronged me. And to have them be like, yeah, I get that, dude. I totally did something just like that. And have this guy who, like, looks really, like, sane and normal say that to me. I'm like, what? Did you really do those things? And, yeah, he totally understood where I was coming from. And that's when I started looking at my part. And when I look at all the people that I'm angry at, and that's another big thing that I tell my sponsees today a lot is, you know, what your side of the street is what I have to look at. I can't control anybody else's side of the street or what anybody else is doing. I just have to look at myself, and that's kind of where I learned how to, first started learning how to do that was in the fourth step. Six and seven is an ongoing process for me. I have to learn who I am before I can even address that, and that's kind of an ever ongoing process. I'm still learning who I am. I'm kind of nerdy. I'm
get super anxious. I'm a little uptight. I used to think I was like this cool cowboy. I really wasn't. I'm really not. But so I'm learning more about myself all the time. And along with my attributes, I learn my defects, and then I pray for God to remove them. The big thing for me is that I don't really try and judge myself for my defects of character. That's a big thing for me. I will beat myself. I'm my worst critic. I beat the crap out of myself for some of my defects of character. But the powerful thing for me is to just notice them, not judge myself for them, notice them, bring God into it, and go on with my day. And throughout that, I haven't really, you know, for me, I don't feel that much different, besides that I don't want to kill myself. I don't feel that much different now than I mean, like, that's rather big. But no, like, for me, the change that I've gone through is other people outside tell me that I'm different. You know, it's not something that I realized happened, but it's something that people, you know, a personality change sufficient to remove the desire to drink. And that has, going through the steps has given that to me. So 6 and 7, I've got to, you know myself. And 8 and 9, I have done most of them. I still have, I had a lot of amends. Throughout my, actually, I had to go turn myself in when I was sober. 6 months sober, I went and turned myself in. I had a felony fugitive warrant out for my arrest in Virginia. So I figured it would be best, you know, if they were going to find me. I was in a halfway house, and figured it would be best if I went up there and turned myself in. And through my antics when I was out on the streets, I had, I'd done like small stints, like 2 weeks, a month, a few in jail. I'd never, those were like DUIs and MIPs and drunken publics and a bunch of, I guess what you would call small incidents. And in these rooms, I guess other people wouldn't call those small incidents. But I was going down there and I had to turn myself in for 10 felonies, and I didn't really... a new way to get out of that one. And the funny thing is, though, I went there and I turned myself in, and that was the shortest stint I ever had in jail. I spent an hour and a half in jail, which is, I mean, I'm on probation for a while, but you know, like, but that was an incredible gift that I can't really explain that one to y'all. Even like what do you call them? The people at the front desk were looking at me like, how did you do that? Like, who do you know? I was like, I don't know anybody. I really don't. I just drove up here from Georgia. I know a couple of the guards that I went to high school with. And I like getting drunk out on a ship. I don't think they hooked it up. That happened, and because of that, I had to pay. That's where I was going with that story, is that is my financial amends I have to make from larceny. I had $23,000 to pay off, which I am still paying off, and took a loan out, and so I pay Wells Fargo every month for that, and that one is a big one. I won't be able to pay my ex-fiance for her stolen rings until I get that one paid off. But my amends, that was the biggest one. But I've made a lot of amends just for, you know, the way I lived and the way I treated people. And I was terrified going into it. It felt just like coming to this meeting for the first time, you know, like I have to sit here. And a lot of them I had resentments towards. And I have to sit here and just talk about the stuff that I did wrong. And, you know, every time I did what my sponsor told me to, I prayed before, I apologized, and I asked if I'd left anything out, and I said, is there anything else I can do? And every time they're like, man, I'm just happy you're not dead. Like, I'm just, you know, like, I'm happy to. Well, one of the guys, I walked in the room, and he like looked at me, and he was like, man, last time I saw you had a cane, like, your hair was almost dreaded, you had a beard, you're skinny, it looked like you're about to die. And like, he barely recognized me, and he was one of my best friends. And it's like, I don't know, it's unbelievable. Everyone that I've made amends to has been just happy that I was doing okay. So, I mean, I don't know if, yeah, that stuff scared me before I even attempted it, but it honestly has been awesome. And for as far as 10, 11, and 12, I try to work those every day. I you know, I don't always admit when I'm wrong, or I definitely still have an ego. But I try to. I think I do it the majority of times. I say sorry when I'm wrong, or I say, you know, I just lied to you. I don't know why I did that. But I did that for a long time. But, so I try to make amends as I go. I meditate in the morning. And a big thing is I'll pause throughout my day and meditate, like, breathe. Like, when I'm up here, I get really nervous and I'll forget to breathe. And I'll just pause and breathe and bring God into it. And that's kind of like a spot meditation that I do a lot. Because I'm still not amazing at dealing with social situations without drugs or alcohol. You know, I'm still learning a lot about that. And then 12 is like this. That's where everything's at for me, man. Like, that's why no counselors or no one with all the frothy emotional appeal, nothing ever got to me. I didn't really care about consequences until somebody with a message with weight behind it, who knew how I felt and they knew what I'd been through, could tell me that, dude, there is a way out. Like, there are people like you that aren't getting messed up, that don't want to kill themselves anymore. And just, I don't know, connecting on that level is the only thing. Every way that I've tried, you know, that the big book talks about, with milk, just beer, like just liquor, just, you know, just this brand. I tried all those things and none of those worked for me. And this has been the only thing that, this is by far the longest I've ever been sober. I've never really been sober. You know, for my abstinence for like 24 hours to 48 hours, minus like prisons and institutions. Jails and institutions never went to a prison. That was probably my ego popping out. You know, I'm hard. But yeah, but no, working with them today, I still have a sponsor. I have a home group. I do service work. I have sponsees who, it's frustrating as shit because some, you know, they won't do exactly what I want them to do, and I want to control them and keep them sober. But, you know, I have to let that stuff go and just. That is the goal. That's why I'm up here. It's not to tell anybody what to do. It's to tell people that, me too. I know how you felt. If you felt like how I felt, I just wanted to stand up here and let you know that there is a way out, and there's another way to live, and you don't have to be miserable. And that's step 12 is why I'm up at this podium, why I'm doing this stuff. And with that, I think you guys might get out a little early. So that's pretty darn close to 50 minutes. All right, so thank you.